We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we learn the history of Confidential Magazine, the 1950s scandal magazine whose mission was to tell the facts and name the names. We also talk with Chicago Tribune columnist Maureen Ryan about the end of the television series Lost and how TV watching has changed in the 21st century, and we hear about a man who ran the Boston Marathon barefoot. We'll have those stories and more this time on Sidetrack. It's marathon season around the U.S. In fact, it was hard to miss the thousands of runners today hitting the streets around Champaign-Urbana as part of the second annual Illinois Marathon. Running a marathon is not easy. Now picture running a marathon barefoot. Independent producer Emily Corwin recently found a man who did just that in this year's Boston Marathon. Some think it's crazy. Others think it's the start of a fitness revolution.
We've got 36 minutes before the start of the 114th running of the Boston Marathon.
At the Athletes Village on the morning of this year's Boston Marathon, thousands of runners mill around in flashy footwear. But there's one guy getting ready for the race who looks a little different. He's got the shirt and the shorts on, but no shoes.
No shoes?
No shoes. I am running the marathon barefoot.
Why?
I don't believe in shoes. They ruin people, so I do my own thing and gotten rid of them a long time ago.
The barefoot runner's name is James Weber, and he seems pretty comfortable in his bare feet. On the other hand, some of the runners around him look perplexed.
Barefoot running sounds crazy. It seems like it would hurt the bottom of your foot.
Why would you want to? I don't understand that.
As it turns out, running a marathon barefoot may not be as crazy as it seems. Daniel Lieberman is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. He made headlines in 2004 showing that humans evolved to be spectacular runners. 6 years later, Lieberman's shaking things up again. This time, he's shown that running sneakers may be the cause of common running injuries.
You know, we now run in a very bizarre way, right? We lace on these huge shoes with these ginormous heels, and what those cause us to do is to land and to run in a way that's bizarre. It's abnormal.
Lieberman says our bodies are better at running the way we evolved to run, barefoot. He's found that when wearing sneakers, most runners strike the ground with their heel first, whereas most barefoot runners strike the ground with their forefoot or midfoot first.
If you took your shoes off and went running down Mass Ave or the Memorial Drive or some other place in the world, you would very quickly stop landing on your heels because it hurts. Because your body comes to this dead stop, and that dead stop involves this huge collision with the ground, with this big shockwave that comes up your body. But if you run in the way which a typical barefoot person runs, and you don't have to run barefoot to do this, you can run in a minimal shoe or even a normal shoe, you don't have that collision, and our hypothesis is that many of the running injuries that people get are caused by landing in this way that is potentially very injurious to the body.
Lieberman's talking about repetitive stress injuries that affect runners' feet, hips, and knees. His research shows that when you run heel first, like most people do in sneakers, the pavement exerts a force on your body up to 3 times your body weight. It's like pounding your heel with a hammer, he says. On the other hand, striking the pavement forefoot first, the way barefoot runners do, puts no force on the body at all.
When you land on the front of your foot is still dropping. It's rotating down that pivot point, which is the front of your foot, the ball of your foot. So there actually is no collision, even on the world's hardest surfaces, if you're running even at an incredibly fast speed.
Lieberman's research has elevated barefoot running from the athletic fringe to a full-on fitness revolution.
Let's run.
In a church auditorium in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 45 people run in circles, barefoot.
Lifting your feet, bend your knees even more than you think you are.
Preston Curtis demonstrates barefoot running at workshops throughout Boston.
When I wear the running shoes, I feel like my body's jarring.
I feel like I'm in a truck that's vibrating really heavily. And then when I run barefoot, I feel like I'm sailing. It's very smooth. It's very tranquil. It's an experience that is just very, very satisfying.
Not everybody buys the whole leave your shoes at home thing. Ed Mastoni is a podiatrist in Cambridge.
I think this day and age, barefoot running is not the best thing for people.
Although Dr. Mastoni does believe barefoot running has biomechanical benefits, he recommends only doing it indoors.
To be running outside on the street, it's too hazardous to somebody's health. I see a number of puncture wounds, foreign bodies, glass cutting through sneakers even, to promote this type of running.
Dr. Mastoni hasn't actually treated a barefoot runner with puncture wounds, but he has seen patients get blisters from running barefoot on the sidewalk. Most barefoot runners who do run on pavement say glass and nails are no big deal. If something's on the sidewalk, they just step around it. The sneaker salesman at City Sports, Ryan Dillman, would rather be more cautious.
You gotta be careful when you're running barefoot. Because there are glass, and you could step on that, cut your foot, and that could indefinitely stop your running.
But even Ryan is excited about the research supporting barefoot running. He just doesn't want to take any chances. So Ryan wears some pretty strange-looking shoes made by a company called Vibram. Vibrams fit like slippers with a rubber sole molded in the shape of a foot. They even have individual places for your toes, almost like a glove.
I ran today in them 5 miles here. I ran last night home in them 5 miles back home. I tore my ACL last spring, had to have surgery over the summer, just learned how to walk again over the summer. And when I heel strike in a normal running shoe, it kills me. I can feel it every step in my left knee. But when I run barefoot style or in Vibrams, I don't feel it at all.
Ryan's not the only one wearing Vibrams these days. Along with all the ordinary sneakers for sale at City Sports, Ryan pointed out 8 different kinds of Vibrams. Back at the marathon, a crowd gathers for blocks around the finish line. After completing the race in 3 hours and 11 minutes, barefoot runner James Weber looks tired but happy.
How do you feel?
I am exhausted and sore. I can't wait to go take a shower.
How do your feet feel?
They're actually really fine. I pretty much just stayed on the divider line the entire way, so it was really nice and smooth and a lot better than some other ones I've ran.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That feature from independent producer Emily Corwin, with production help from Rob Rosenthal. You're listening to Sidetrack. The current economy is slowing cash flow across the globe, and some people are turning to bartering to meet their needs. A group of artists in New York have set up a website where people can barter to learn new skills. Independent producer Stephanie Hughes has more.
So stand in a circle. Let's all look at each other. Come closer. We're just going to go from foot to foot and move our bodies a little bit, get warmed up.
On Manhattan's Lower East Side, Eve Pollock is teaching a group of people how to swing dance. But unlike most things in New York City, the class doesn't cost any money. Instead, students are required to barter for something the instructor would like. It's part of a new initiative called the Trade School. In Eve's case, she just asked for enthusiasm, but she thinks the notion of free exchange has lots of potential.
Yeah, I think bartering is beautiful because it emphasizes the skills and the love and the friendship instead of the monetary value. And you're still getting what you would have bought with the money that you would have been given.
Eve taught her class during the trade school's opening session in early 2010. Swing dancing wasn't the only class offered. The trade school provided instruction on subjects as varied as how to make felt, grant writing, and foraging for mushrooms in New York City. In exchange, the teachers asked for all kinds of things.
Some teachers are like, this is a list of things that I need. Like, I need pencils, and I need fruit, and I need this. Other people are like, I'd like you to bring a collaborative dance move and perform it for me on video.
Rich Watts is one of the five co-founders of the trade school. He actually obtained the space where the classes were being held by bartering.
I bartered work. I bartered time. I actually have worked with the people for a while here, and they had been interested in doing a classroom for a couple of years. And the opportunity came up where I knew the space was going to be available, and I had done a bunch of work for them, and I'm like, hey, how about instead of paying me, we just barter for the space? And they were into that.
The space actually functioned as the physical counterpart to the barter website, Our Goods, which is still in the works. The group believes that having a physical space allows people to forge relationships that could lead to trading. Another co-founder, Caroline Woolard, says barter is a process that requires some face time.
Barter is nuanced relationship. It's something where you have to find someone whose skill set and personality work with yours on some level. So having a storefront allows a wider network of people to get to know each other over time.
And getting to know each other is required if a barter system is really going to work. That's according to economist Daniel Martin. He's a PhD candidate at NYU who advised the group.
Certainly you develop a relationship with the people that you buy from. So when you buy your coffee in the morning, you develop a relationship with those people. So regular exchange has relationships embedded in it. But I think barter, in particular these kinds of networks, have an even more social aspect to them.
And being social is important if you hope to get by in hard times. That's when barter economies generally tend to crop up. Caroline Woolard says that in a recession, people who are unemployed can really benefit from figuring out how to trade.
There are times when there's enough energy to make a lot of things happen, but not enough money. A lot of people are unemployed, sitting at home, twiddling their thumbs or getting depressed or, who knows, looking for a job all day when they could still be making things and trading with each other.
At the moment, that trading on Our Goods is mostly between artists and other creative types. But the founders hope that it could branch out to include people from all professions. Doctors, hairdressers, auto mechanics. Economist Daniel Martin says if there's something those workers want in return, that could work.
Because maybe they would like those services that the artist could provide. Maybe they would like those goods that the artist could provide. But there's not a market for those. So now what this does is become the market for those things.
It's possible that market could move beyond New York City. Rich Watt says eventually they'd like to see a barter site in every town that wants one.
We kind of see Our Goods working like Craigslist does in that regard, where they rolled out a Craigslist site for cities that could support a Craigslist site. And that's kind of the way we see Our Goods. We already have people who've been contacting us from Cleveland, and we have people who are in San Francisco, Philadelphia, who are interested in starting Our Goods. And as soon as the site is ready, that we think it's ready to kind of spread like that, we'll launch in different areas.
But in the meantime, back in New York, Deirdre Sawinski and Brad Williams were at the swing dance lesson, where they were still working out what a proper trade would entail.
I don't know what people would trade for my skills, but I think it's kind of fun. It's a great idea to see what you're worth.
Deirdre is a belly dancer, and she's thinking of teaching classes. And she asked, what should I barter for? And I told her, just get cat toys, because you like watching your cat play with them.
Maybe that exchange can take place this fall. The trade school founders have launched a campaign on the website Kickstarter to get funding for another round of bartering in September. Meanwhile, the Our Goods website is expected to be launched to the public sometime this summer.
That feature from independent producer Stephanie Hughes. You're tuned to Sidetrack. Three weeks from tomorrow, millions of TV viewers will be hearing these words for the last time.
Previously on Lost.
On May 23rd, the phenomena on ABC launched in 2004 by J.J. Abrams will come to a close. Lost has been a bona fide hit, earning big ratings while generating websites, books, DVD sales, and toys for its fans. Jeff Bosser talked with Chicago Tribune TV critic Maureen Ryan about the final weeks of the show, if anything might take its place soon, and what role social media has played in the show's popularity.
every time we see the end of the show, we're either shocked or scratching our heads. May 23rd at, what, 10 p.m., that all goes away. Have you been able to prepare yourself for that?
No, I definitely am not prepared. I think I have a little bit of experience in saying goodbye to some of my favorite shows, but it's not, you know, every show is different. And I think Lost is going to be especially hard to say goodbye to because it's something that's so fun to talk about and analyze and discuss with your friends or your coworkers. So it's kind of like that whole experience of the show is going away.
Can you recall anything prior to this that has had this kind of phenomenon in terms of fans following and emailing each other and posting notes on the web and that sort of thing? And this intelligent a program is quoting you from several of your columns.
I think there's been something of a precedent in that, you know, going all the way back to NYPD Blue, there were sort of, that was the beginnings of online message boards and sites and stuff like that, or Buffy the Vampire Slayer certainly had huge, huge online presence, and especially genre shows like Battlestar Galactica, you know, and even going back further than that, you know, Star Trek certainly had a fan community. But I think Lost is the first time, I think, a show that is a very big populist hit, at least out of the gate, is also something that gets this incredible fan response and, you know, online response. That's something I think that's pretty unique, and I don't know that we'll see that again.
Can you attribute some, I assume we can attribute some ratings to that?
I think all the online response has helped the show, because I think Lost came of age in an era that actually turned out to be pretty crucial for television in general, in that the number of times people bought or watched a show on iTunes or on Hulu or all these various other ways helped keep shows alive. I think that Lost would have stayed alive no matter what, but I think it was very important to the show that the DVDs sold well, the merchandise sold well. It kind of gave network executives a different model to look at, and Lost was really at the forefront of that. And I think that definitely all the responses that it got in all these different realms, including, you know, even at the beginning, and there may still be some now, but the first couple seasons there were some fan conventions that fans themselves put together. So I think that really helped keep the show going, in my view.
How much of this is the J.J. Abrams factor and just his creativity that has also spawned things like Alias and normally has his name attached to something has meant at least some success?
Yeah, I think what's kind of interesting about the show is that, you know, I think his name definitely helped get the show made. And his creativity in the first season, especially in that pilot, was undeniable. But what's cool is that it really went on and became its own thing. And, you know, he's now gone on to be a very successful film director, and he still has his hand in some TV projects here and there. But he handed over the reins to the team of Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, who I think really took the show and ran with it. Because that first season, as the creators have talked about many times, was, you know, kind of a roller coaster ride, and they were just really going by the seat of their pants. And then, of course, you know, over time they've built up a very elaborate mythology, and I think it's starting to become obvious that they did have a plan, despite what some fans seem to think. But, you know, it's really become its own thing. It organically grew thanks to the cast and the crew and the writers. And I think what's interesting is that some latter-day characters and stories that weren't even in that first run of episodes that J.J. Abrams was involved with have become the dominant or most important things about Lost. So to me, that's a sign that it really had legs, you know, well beyond that first season, because now we're talking about people from season 3 or season 2 or people we met late in the show are actually really important.
As we're recording this, I think one of the shows, I guess, that's intended to pick up where Lost is leaving off is a series on ABC called Happy Town, and I think your column it indicated it may not be all that it's cracked up to be.
Well, no, I think what networks keep getting wrong is this fundamental idea about what made Lost a success. Yes, now as we're kind of into the middle and end of Lost, it became about the, to a certain degree, it became about the mysteries and answering those questions. But I don't necessarily think of that that's how you should start when you go to create a show. Like, let's think of the mystery. I mean, really, when you watched that Lost pilot, you thought, boy, I have no idea what's going on, but these people are really kind of interesting to me, and I want to know what they're up to and what they're going to do next. And so, I think people are going about show creation the wrong way, and they're trying to think of the mystery when really what they should think about is creating a really compelling world and really compelling characters in that world, and then kind of bring in the overarching plot more strongly as you get going and as you've got an audience.
Well, exactly. I mean, Wes, what we built our knowledge of Lost on for a good while was instead of all these elements of time travel and alternate universes,
right.
it was these episodes introducing a character, and then we did flashbacks on as to what they were all about.
It was really a brilliant way to bring people in because it made it about the person. Like, you know, why is this couple from Korea on such rocky ground? What's wrong with their marriage? And so you became interested in the person's story. And then exactly as you say, we really didn't get into time travel and playing around with all these really big ideas and really huge sci-fi elements until much later in the show, by which point we already cared about the people. And that's really the key that drew me in personally.
Well, is anything have a chance of replacing it, or are we just going to keep our producers? Is it going to take a while for them to get this right?
I think it's going to take a while. I think the next Lost is going to creep up on us. It's not going to announce itself as, hey, this show wants to be just like Lost. I think the shows that get compared to Lost are sort of in this unfortunate position that they have a really high bar to clear. But I had this interesting experience with Battlestar Galactica where, you know, I am a sci-fi nut, so I enjoyed that. And I kind of was thinking, where will my next sci-fi fix come from? Or where will another show that involves me emotionally to this level with this group of tight characters come from? And actually, weirdly enough, you know, I spent some time missing that show. But then last year I got really into a show that's on the surface radically different. It's called Sons of Anarchy on FX. And actually, it's funny because I sort of found the fix of what I got out of Battlestar on a show that's set, you know, not in space, but on Earth amongst bikers. But to me, it had the same level of intensity. So I think sometimes, you know, if we're looking for a show about an island with a mystery and a polar bear and time travel, you know, we're not going to get that again. But hopefully we'll find something else that is interesting to talk about. You know, I'm always looking for that, certainly when I get network sending me new shows. I'm always hoping for something that'll become that engrossing and that deep. That is also just kind of fun to watch. Just, you look back at that Lost pilot, which I guess they're going to rebroadcast the weekend of the finale, and it's just a great film. You know, you can sit down and watch that and not care about sci-fi or not care about time travel or not care about the Dharma Initiative, and you can still get drawn in just by a great story being told.
For something completely different that you're writing a little bit about now, I also have to ask you quickly about Glee, and just the thing that you brought up this week is that who else may appear on the show or who else's songs may be performed on the show, and I thought that was kind of a fun column.
Yeah, there's a lot of people interested, and to me it's sort of starting to feel already like American Idol, where, you know, bands were really reticent when Idol first came out to have license their music or let the singers use their songs, and then they were sort of beating down the door saying, please, we want to be on American Idol. It's great exposure. So I think in a very accelerated time frame that's happening with Glee, you know, we had the Madonna episode. Now apparently Britney Spears wants her back catalog to be used on the show possibly. So I think really in this really radically changing music industry, artists are looking for ways to expose their music that aren't necessarily the radio, because, you know, radio and music is just changing so much that they are desperate for any exposure. And so a show like Glee, which it doesn't even have really the numbers that Lost did its first season, but it does very well. But even a show like that can sort of negotiate deals with some of the artists that you would think, wow, I would never have thought that Madonna would let that happen, but she really understood. This is another way to sort of extend her brand.
Okay, one question for us Lost nerds. Any thoughts on how the season will end? Will we see the alternate universe where all these people that crashed on the island moving on with their lives instead? Will this universe merge with that one, or is it just way too up in the air?
I think you have to see the two universes merge. I mean, that's my hope anyway, is that, you know, that we get some kind of really reliable or interesting connection between them. And And my theory is, and basically just, you know, this is not giving anything away because all my theories always turn out to be wrong, but I think so much of Lost is a popcorn ride and a thrill ride and an adventure, but it's also got a moral underpinning, which I think is really important and what's kind of given it legs over time. So I think really my theory, and a lot of other people think, maybe what it becomes is they have to choose. They have to choose between timelines, and the timeline that they choose might involve giving up something that they really wanted. But Lost is, you know, I don't think a happy ending is that everyone gets what they want. I think a happy ending for the characters would involve them making a choice that they feel that they can live with. So I don't know if it will involve choice between the timelines, but that's just my theory.
Jeff Bosser talked with Tribune TV critic and fellow Lost fan Maureen Ryan on the end of the show after six seasons. Ryan's column, The Watcher, can be found in print a couple of times a week and online daily at chicagotribune.com/watcher. Still to come, the history of America's most scandalous scandal magazine, and modern English lit students who think classic characters need therapy. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Now, most people have had strange babysitting experiences, but no one has ever had one like Don Hornig. Independent producer Nate DeMeo has more.
Oppenheimer was worried. The Manhattan Project was just so big. There were more than 30 work sites at offices with nothing written on their doors, and there were 130,000 people working on the thing. 130,000 pairs of potentially loose lips. And no matter what lengths they went to keep them from talking to each other, no matter what lengths they went to keep all but the key personnel from ever even guessing at the big picture, from ever knowing that the circuit board they were assembling, or that those lenses they'd been grinding, would all come together to build a weapon that would be, by factors of 10, the deadliest thing that anyone had ever built. There were still too many people who knew too much. Too many potential spies who knew they were going to finally test the thing in the morning. Who knew that Truman was in Potsdam with Stalin and Churchill, counting on success. And there were too many potential saboteurs who knew too many ways to stop the thing from going off, or worse, to make it go off too soon. And now the gadget, that's what they called the deadliest thing anyone had ever built. The gadget was just out there all alone in the middle of the desert, hanging from a steel tower, 100 feet in the air. And there was a storm rolling in. 2 years earlier, Don Hornig's wife Lily picked up the phone in their little house out on Cape Cod. The couple had just moved in after their honeymoon, after Don wrapped up his PhD at Harvard at the age of 23. Lily was working on her own PhD that summer, and on planting the little garden they'd both dreamed about. The man on the phone said Don was needed by his government. He couldn't tell them what the project was. He couldn't tell them what his job would be. He couldn't tell them where they were going. But they'd better get going. 2 years later, Robert Oppenheimer was looking for someone to babysit the A-bomb. He needed someone who understood how the bomb worked. And Hornig had designed the trigger system, so if someone had sabotaged it by swapping out a wire or loosening a screw, Hornig might catch it. And they needed someone young. The other scientists were too important to lose in some sort of atomic catastrophe. They had kids. They had tenure. And since they didn't give him a weapon with which to defend either himself or the weapon they were banking on to win the war, maybe he'd be fit enough to wrestle any Nazis who came to blow the thing up. Now, I will tell you right now that there is no big twist coming here. Don Hornig doesn't remove his lab coat to reveal an SS uniform underneath. There is no moment when the young scientist, long disrespected by his older Nobel laureate bosses, looks up at the bomb to realize that those great men had spent so much time contemplating the atom in the origins of the universe, they'd overlook one tiny detail, which Hornick fixes with some chewing gum and a sprig of rosemary, which he always kept tucked behind his ear to remind him of that little garden he and his wife had left behind in the Cape and of the life they would someday return to when they finally woke up from this nightmare. So no, there's no twist. I tell you all of that backstory just to leave you with this. Sometime after midnight, on July 16th, 1945, just hours before the Trinity test, which would lead to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the end of the war and the start of the Cold War and decades of regret and fear and environmental catastrophe and all of it, one 25-year-old guy sat in a small three-sided corrugated aluminum box with one side open to the elements, 100 feet above the desert, atop a steel tower, in a thunderstorm. And while he listened to the rain pinging and rattling on the metal roof, and sat in a folding chair under a bare 60-watt bulb, thumbing through a dog-eared paperback collection of funny short stories, James Thurber, Dorothy Parker, Mark Twain, trying to distract himself from thinking about what would happen if a rain-soaked steel tower in the middle of the desert, holding one man and one nuclear bomb, were struck by lightning. While his colleagues sat in bunkers that the math had told them needed to be at least 10 miles away for safety. And while he wondered if his trigger system would work and about how the office pool would turn out, the one where physicists placed bets on the outcome of the test, ranging from total dud to an explosion that would ignite all of the nitrogen in the Earth's atmosphere, destroying all life on the planet. And how Army scientists were calculating how many people would die, depending on the various outcomes of the morning's test. And how Truman and Churchill were hoping that it would at least be big enough to end this goddamn mess. There was just a guy in a box with a bomb.
That was independent producer Nate DeMeo. You can hear his podcast, The Memory Palace, at www.thememorypalace.us. Tuned to Sidetrack. Was Bartleby the Scribner depressed? Did Clarissa Dalloway need lithium? Today's English Lit students seem to want to medicate away the problems of classic literary characters. Independent producer Eric Malinsky explores this phenomenon.
There's a professor at NYU who's taught the work of Sylvia Plath for years. One day, her students started to react differently to the poet.
And they were like, I mean, she's such a whiner, Sylvia Plath. She's just like whining in every poem. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, you know, when I was in high school, she was my hero.
When I visited Elaine Tobin's class at NYU, the freshmen were discussing two short stories, Bliss by Catherine Mansfield and Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville.
I would prefer to be left alone here, said Bartleby, as if offended at being mobbed in his privacy.
The students were tossing around the usual liberal arts interpretations.
I know the feminist lens, the Marxist lens, right?
But something new was added to the mix. They were diagnosing the characters.
I'm thinking maybe schizophrenic or...
Okay. And manifesting almost a mania.
I don't know if it's a problem more than a coping mechanism.
He's depressed.
Like, he just seems like someone who's very disturbed.
Something psychological or something that happened to him when he was younger.
I felt some sympathy for Bartleby. Like, what is wrong with him? Why can't anyone help him?
My students do not like misery. They would like to fix the characters.
Tobin hates the idea of fixing a classic character, like Captain Ahab from Moby Dick.
What happens if Ahab just chills out one day, right? He starts taking Klonopin, he's fine, just gets over the thing with the same, he just has, like,
that whale and I have no problem with him. Just let him go off and enjoy his whale life and meet a nice female whale. And, you know, like, you know, it's the unhealthiness of Ahab's obsession that makes it great literature.
But this is the first generation to grow up in a world where taking psychological medication is considered normal, even for kids.
It really is like these are the vitamins I take every day.
And there's been a cultural shift as well. Tobin calls it the Oprah effect.
So I guess for me, the Oprah effect is this sort of opening of dialogue in America about personal issues and personal crises, but with a really psychological bent and a self-healing bent.
She sees it when her students write personal essays.
And my favorite example of this is I had a student who was related to John Wilkes Booth, who wrote about her great-great-great-uncle and what it was like to be in an infamous family. And the final line of the piece was, many think of John Wilkes Booth as the man who assassinated Abraham Lincoln, but I think of him as a failed actor who made some bad decisions. I just wrote no.
You got to accentuate positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
But when literature is designed to stir empathy, sometimes you want to reach through time and help these poor guys.
I challenge anyone to read The Sorrows of Young Werther and not think, you know, my goodness, somebody should take care of that. If only he had Prozac.
Peter Kramer is a psychiatrist. He wrote Listening to Prozac, the book that made antidepressants a household name. He says stories that romanticize melancholy and depression should be demoted to examples of a bygone era.
You know, on the one hand, you have some set of beliefs that come from an era where we didn't understand mental illness as well and had, in any case, less means of altering it. And on the other hand, I think you have, you know, probably a sadder but wiser perspective, one that is less rich imaginatively, but I think probably offers more hope in a practical sense.
This discussion is not just happening in classrooms. When the novelist Michael Cunningham does readings, people will come up to him and say things like,
I didn't want to read your book because I was afraid it would be depressing.
He has to bite his tongue.
So your purchase on happiness feels so precarious that you think this slender tome is going to actually topple you over into something so deep and dark you might not come back? What about a certain sorrow as part of the richness of human life, as part of the ride?
Cunningham is best known for writing The Hours, a novel about Virginia Woolf. He tried to craft his Virginia Woolf in her own time, but the modern world just kept creeping into his mind.
And one of the great questions among those of us who care about Virginia Woolf and think about her work and her life is Virginia on lithium. Would it have changed the work? Would we have Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse and The Waves if Virginia Woolf had been properly medicated?
Could she have written about her character's emotions so convincingly?
When Clarissa Dalloway, exulting in her morning's errands, says, life, London, this moment of June, for somebody like Woolf to write about that kind of pleasure in the pure physical world is something. If Virginia Woolf can write about happiness in her characters, we trust her because we know she knew just how bad it could get.
Professor Tobin agrees. The job of art is not to correct humanity, but to show us humanity in all of its extremes.
Of course, it's really fun to look at literary characters and think, okay, what contemporary disorder are they most likely suffering from? If we give them a label, I think it's easier. It simplifies them as characters, which is the opposite of what I think is wonderful about literature, right? That literature often is about being complex.
But a 21st century Virginia Woolf would live in an era where Prozac is an option. A modern-day Lady Macbeth would know the term obsessive-compulsive disorder. Whether they would use those tools to alter their minds and their fates, well, that's up to the next generation of writers. Those books I want to read. I'm Eric Molinsky.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Today, celebrity-based news is everywhere, on television, on newsstands, and online. Websites like TMZ and publications like the National Enquirer are skirting dangerously close to becoming legitimate news-gathering operations. But it seems none of this would have been possible without a single magazine from the 1950s. That magazine was Confidential. It was the magazine that claimed to tell the facts and name the names. It was also the magazine that everyone read, but no one admitted they read. A book about the history of Confidential magazine is now out. It's titled Shocking True Story, The Rise and Fall of Confidential, America's Most Scandalous Scandal Magazine. It's published by Pantheon. The book covers the history of the magazine's flamboyant publisher Robert Harrison and the others who made the magazine what it was. And to give readers a taste of what the magazine was like, each chapter starts with an excerpt like What Makes Ava Gardner Run for Sammy Davis Jr., Robert Mitchum, the nude who came to dinner, and Why Joe DiMaggio is Striking Out with Marilyn Monroe. I recently talked with the author of the book, Henry E. Scott. I first asked him to tell me the basics about the magazine.
It was America's first really big scandal magazine. And it was a magazine that was different from any other magazine that dealt a little bit in scandal, in that most of what Confidential reported, almost all of it, in fact, was true.
And we're talking about the 1950s here.
Right.
And about the only thing comparable were the fan magazines that came out that had all the backing of the movie studios.
Absolutely.
Confidential was the exact opposite of this.
Mm-hmm. I think that was probably shown most dramatically in a story published by Look magazine, which had a wonderful cover story about Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball and their two children on the cover. And they were presented as America's, or Hollywood's rather, prototypical kind of wonderful family. And the very same month, Confidential came out with a story about Desi Arnaz cheating on Lucy. So it pretty dramatically gave the lie to what the rest of the media was saying about Hollywood.
Now, what other types of stories could you read within the pages of Confidential?
Well, the big circulation drivers were stories about celebrity scandal, but the magazine also focused on politics, particularly later in its life when it had as its editor someone who had worked with Joe McCarthy and had been a noted anti-communist in the country. So they wrote a lot of stories about supposedly hidden Reds in powerful places. Confidential also did a lot of consumer-oriented stories, stories about the dangers of cigarette smoking, about wacky topics like the fact that your kid wearing a Davy Crockett coonskin cap might actually get some sort of skin rash.
Now, the guy in charge of all this was a man by the name of Robert Harrison.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what he was like and what was the driving force for him to publish this magazine.
Well, Bob Harrison was a pretty colorful character. He was the son of immigrants who fled what is now Russia, escaping the pogroms of the late 1890s, came to the United States, and his father was a man who worked with his hands. And Harrison really would have nothing of that. He was really the consummate playboy. So early on, he found himself working for the New York Graphic, which is a fairly eccentric newspaper for its time. Left that job when it closed, found himself working for an ad agency focused on Hollywood, and basically fell in love with kind of the bright lights of the entertainment world. He was based in New York, however, so most of what he focused on was Broadway. And he was a man who delighted in escorting, you know, pretty chorus girls to clubs around town. Different people have different ideas about why Bob Harrison launched Confidential and got excited about it. But I think pretty much everyone who knew him saw it as a way for Bob Harrison to project his image on as much of the world as he could. And to basically be known. He was a man with quite an ego. He claims that he did the magazine largely because it was a wonderful public service to let people know about problems with cigarettes and problems with scandal in Hollywood that needed to be dealt with because it was immoral. But the reality was Bob Harrison was all about promoting Bob Harrison.
And he had no problem currying favor with certain people like Walter Winchell, who he would write a lot of very favorable articles about. And as you point out in the book, he kind of made Walter Winchell, or Walter Winchell became the patron saint of Confidential magazine.
Yeah, he was a very smart guy in that regard. Early on, he realized that Winchell, who had probably the largest audience, radio audience in the United States, and also was beginning to appear on television and also wrote a newspaper column, was somebody who could help him out, if only he could figure out a way to get Winchell to do it. So what he did was he decided to focus Confidential on enemies of Walter Winchell's and write disparaging stories about them. It worked. Soon, Walter Winchell was holding the magazine up on his television show, talking about it on his radio show, and describing it as his favorite mag. He was so excited about it that there was a pretty widespread rumor that Winchell himself was one of the backers of the magazine, which wasn't true.
But the thing about it, which is really interesting, is that, you know, even with Walter Winchell's endorsement of the magazine, this was a magazine that people never really admitted that they read, but it would sell tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of copies every time it came out, and it would actually, at certain points, outsell a lot of other popular magazines of the day.
Actually, it would sell eventually millions of copies. This was the amazing thing about it. 25 cents a pop, and it became the best-selling newsstand publication in America. It was a magazine no one admitted to reading, but everyone read. And it hysterical because people talked about getting on an airplane and noticing a sober-looking businessman reading a copy of the Wall Street Journal, perhaps, and tucked inside of it was a copy of Confidential magazine. You know, the reality was people like to know about scandal, and I've described it to people as being related to, I think, America's sort of genetic disposition to something the Germans call Schadenfreude, a real delight in the misfortunes of others. And Confidential certainly poked lots of holes in the reputations of famous and glamorous people.
And the writing, I got to admit, even 50 years on, the writing for this magazine is really fun to read.
It was brilliant. One of Harrison's beliefs was that for a story to really work well, it had to sound good when it was read aloud. He was a big believer in alliteration and funny terms. So as part of the editorial process, he would have the stories read aloud and would have various employees, sometimes the elevator operator or a doorman, come in and listen to the stories and decide if they liked the way the story sounded. So it made it tremendously entertaining. It was almost like listening to something on the radio.
Well, for a while there, Confidential magazine was pretty much untouchable. They were saying all this stuff about the movie studios hated it. But for a while, there was nothing they could do about it. And how did that happen?
Well, it happened largely because unlike the other fan magazines that were out there and magazines like Hollywood Reporter that covered the industry, Confidential did not depend on the industry. It didn't require advertising dollars from the Hollywood studios. It wasn't beholden to them. It wasn't owned by any of the studio executives. And so Robert Harrison also lived in New York City, and while he covered Hollywood because it helped him sell magazines, he could care less about Hollywood. He found it a boring and uninteresting town. So Confidential made its money off that 25 cents a copy, which sounds like a small sum today, but was a decent amount of money back then. And when you're selling millions of copies at 25 cents a piece, you can make some real money. So this was a magazine that wasn't beholden to the studios. Nobody could ever call them and say, we're going to pull our movie ad if you write something nasty about us again.
And they also had a Confidential magazine, that is, also had a really large and intricate network of tipsters.
Absolutely. Harrison initially set that up on his own, but eventually when he realized how important Hollywood was and he couldn't just count on stories to sort of come over the transom, he sent his niece and her husband to Hollywood, and they set up a separate business called the Hollywood Research Bureau, and they pretty quickly let everyone in Hollywood know that they would pay real money for really interesting stories. So you had reporters for legitimate newspapers, you had policemen, you had private detectives, you had bartenders, you had had all sorts of people who, whether they were down on their luck or just needed help making the rent, would turn to Confidential with a really cool story.
And the thing that amazes me, beyond this web of tipsters, they actually had a lot of lawyers and private eyes themselves that would do some serious fact-checking.
Yeah, it was interesting. Harrison's lawyer, Aldo Stefano, wonderful man who died just a few years ago, told me all about how important this was to the magazine. In two regards. One was they didn't want to get sued and end up, you know, having to go out of business. And the second thing was they really decided that their credibility with their audience was what made them stand out. So they invested an enormous amount of money hiring various detectives, people not just in the United States but around the world, who would go out and get affidavits and research stories. There were stories they turned down because they couldn't prove them.
So what was the final nail in the coffin for this golden age of Confidential magazine?
Well, the final nail, it was all about politics, ultimately. The Hollywood studios finally were fed up, and they went to the Attorney General of California, Pat Brown, who was going to be running for governor, and said, you've got to do something about this magazine. We can't take it anymore. And if you don't do something about it, you're not going to get our support in the election. So Pat Brown brought a lawsuit against Confidential in California, on a fairly trumped-up charge, most people agree, of conspiracy to commit criminal libel. So his idea was to pressure everyone in California, all the news dealers. He threatened to sue them if they continued to sell the magazine. And he brought Harrison's niece and her husband to trial. He said, I'm going to shut this magazine down. Now, it was interesting. Confidential was defended by a very smart lawyer. His strategy was to bring as many Hollywood people who'd been written about in Confidential as possible to the witness stand and force them to testify to the truth about the various scandals they were involved in. So this made this the O.J. Simpson trial of its time. And the courtroom was packed. It was covered by newspapers around the world, in France, in London, and it was on the front page of newspapers in this country, including the New York Times, virtually every day. The jury on the criminal libel case came back and convicted Confidential, found them guilty on some pretty minor charges, but not overall on this whole question of criminal libel. So the question became, did the state want to take Confidential back into the courtroom and try them again, or was there a settlement possible?
And it seemed that at that point, Bob Harrison just wanted to cut his losses.
Bob Harrison wanted to cut his losses. He'd spent a lot of money, and above all, he was a real family man. He wasn't married, he didn't have children, but he worked with his sisters. They all shared the same office, and the one thing he was really afraid of was that his niece, who was sitting there in Los Angeles, might go to jail. So they signed an agreement to stop covering scandal, and in a year, the magazine lost basically 90% of its circulation.
And that was pretty much the end for Confidential. Bob Harrison sold it, but it went on for a little while, but it was never the same.
Never the same. Nope, absolutely.
So here's the interesting thing. You know, back in the 1950s, Confidential magazine, although it was widely read, was in a way considered way out of the mainstream, way out of the legitimate world of journalism.
Right, right.
Well, fast forward 50 years, and it seems we almost have a convergence of the two.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. You know, what I find fascinating is today you have press agents who actually, you know, spend some effort promoting the infidelity of their clients because that helps them make their reputation. I mean, when you look at John Gosselin and Kate Gosselin, those two people would probably never have become as big a name as they have if it weren't for the fact that Gosselin was having an affair with someone else and the relationship broke up. So today in America, with reality television and all of this other stuff, there's not such a premium on hiding scandal. Often you find people who are celebrities for no evident reason actually involved in promoting the scandal they're involved in.
Well, in this modern era of, you know, infotainment and sort of this tabloid journalism, how much did Confidential magazine, you know, contribute to that? How much does this magazine, Confidential, play in the history of modern journalism and modern media?
I think it played a huge role. For one thing, even though Confidential was effectively shut down, an idea that struck many other people as brilliant, and so a number of competitors were launched while Confidential was still running. Hollywood eventually realized they could not shut all of these guys down. So the notion of scandal journalism was born in a big way with Confidential, and it never went away. So lots of people realized that America had a passion for this sort of information, the story behind the story, as Confidential would describe it. Confidential also came about at an interesting time in American history when there was probably some cynicism. Soldiers had come back from World War II. They'd seen a different part of the world. They looked at things a bit differently. People were moving out of cities and moving to the suburbs, and interstate highways were being built. And the whole notion of kind of close, intimate family life was changing. America changed pretty rapidly. And, of course, then we got into the 60s, and we all know how radically different that time was. So Confidential both came at an important time and I think also contributed to the different way of looking at America and looking at our image as Americans. Yeah, what's most interesting to me was the image Hollywood presented to Americans was this incredibly pure, sweet image of people who never cheated on their spouses. There were no interracial relationships. There were no gay people to speak of. And, you know, America finally learned through Confidential that none of this was true, that all these sorts of relationships existed, even in Hollywood.
Well, I know you're touching on it, but if you could sum up Confidential's legacy, what would it be?
I think Confidential's legacy was to put the lie to Hollywood. And to basically, Confidential created a mirror that showed America what it was really like.
That was Henry E. Scott, author of Shocking True Story, The Rise and Fall of Confidential, America's Most Scandalous Scandal Magazine. It's published by Pantheon. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.